It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 87.
Fighting against deficiencies in imagination every week.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
We have with us today Liz Burke. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
We are going to talk about three particular things today. The Romance Writers of America's recent weird same-sex literature entry policy. The Flavor Wire's 10 great science fiction books for women. Specifically girls. Should probably use the correct terminology that they've used. And then, of course, yeah. a roundtable that we've kind of all missed out on, I guess, is the Global Women in Science Fiction Roundtable at the World SF blog. So that's essentially where we're going to start. But I hear that, Liz, you have a question for us.
I do. I'm incredibly curious as to why you asked me on here. Because I'm only really started reviewing books last year, and I'm not a writer, and I'm not important.
But think of all the stir that you've created since starting writing reviews.
I'd really rather not.
That's really why we want you. You're a troublemaker. No, I mean...
Go ahead, Jen.
Sean. Hey.
Sean? Was it Sean?
Yeah, let's make sure, you know, I've got a reputation to uphold.
Speak with a lower voice.
Oh, yes. No, I'm not going to do that. You've been paying attention. You write for tor.com. You've written reviews of Strange Horizons, particularly a recent review where you, stirred
the... I awoke the fan rage of the internet.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Essentially. And of course, you did that again when you, a recent post on women in military science fiction, in which a certain fellow who we would depose to be the appropriate term, or...
No, we just called him a douche nozzle. I don't think we necessarily deposed him. He's still out there wearing his little crown of sexism.
Okay. Well, essentially, you know, you stirred that. Well, actually, he more stirred it. You just said something, and then he, like...
I said something, and then he said, I think... probably about one third or more based on word count of the comments. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then he got upset at, that they banned him for being a jerk. And then of course he thinks that when we closed the comments on our post about him, that in fact we did that because of him. And in fact, actually, no, I closed the comments like seconds after he'd left his last comment and hadn't seen the comment, but he won't listen to this cause he hates us and we're hosing bag now.
But yeah, I love that nickname. People who know my real last name, which I'm not going to put on the air, but people who know it know that bag is incredibly appropriate for me. I have to give him props for that.
Yeah. So what you're saying is two troublemakers invited another troublemaker on the show.
Exactly. But do we need any other reason than that, really?
I didn't set out to make trouble. I'm just having opinions in public.
Crazy bats. How dare you have opinions in public?
And especially, how dare a woman have opinions in public? Come on.
Exactly.
You know, haven't you ladies
Don't
learned
be
something?
Don't be the man, Sean.
Well, what's interesting is that your original post, aside from the... shitstorm that arose from it about women in military science fiction was spot on. And part of the reason that I was initially attracted to it is because it's one of my favorite topics. Sean and I have discussed it before. I don't think necessarily specifically in military science fiction, but women in science fiction and women writing science fiction, period. So when the shitstorm arose preceding, I always forget which, the post, that was exciting for us.
Well, it gives us an opportunity to babble.
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah. I mean, basically, I thought that all I was saying was that I really wanted more people who looked like me blowing things up in space. But, hey.
But you can't do that. Yeah. You forget. If you let women in the military, they will become prostitutes.
And fall in love. And
no, the prostitute thing
and
is the
get
big
raped.
One. Yeah. No, he doesn't care about the rape one. He doesn't. He barely ever mentions that.
God. Yeah, other people did though. So I'm not sticking to him because he wasn't the only one with completely disagreeable comments on that thread. Was really what it was.
Oh, that's sure. And something unrelated to this. There's a blog called Requires Hate. I forget the exact title. Who tore one of the like pinnacles of the SFF community, Pat at Pat's Fantasy Hot List, tore him a new one for his rather disparaging opinions about Thailand and Southeast Asia, because she's from Thailand, and a lot of people essentially implied that she should be raped. And those were the comments that he approved after saying that he would only not approve. Yeah, so, but that's has nothing to do with this episode. This is
no, nothing at all.
Yeah,
but I think go ahead.
If you guys might want troublemakers, maybe you should invite her.
Oh yeah, because she would not pull any punches. That's for sure.
No, I think we should track her down. And I think it just points to an issue within the community. Within most communities, sexism is still very prevalent, and by ignoring it, sweeping it under the rug, or shutting down people who disagree with the amount of sexism, that's a problem. And the trolls should be called out at every opportunity.
I can't say I disagree.
Hear, hear.
Excellent.
So why don't we get started here? The short of it is that the Romance Writers Association decided, or Romance Writers of America, which one is it? I can't remember.
Romance Writers of America?
Whatever, RWA. Romance Writers, the first two letters, that's all that matters.
Okay.
Apparently they changed a policy now. They're no longer taking same-sex entries in any category.
I think that was only one of their chapters.
One chapter, yes.
Yeah, one chapter. Yeah, the ink chapter, as the website tells us. More Than Magic contest hosted by Romance Writers Ink Chapter. So specifically the contest rules, is not letting same-sex entries in any category, which understandably has angered people, and rightly should, because it's a really dumb policy.
Especially if you're taking non-heteronormative people's membership fees, I suppose, in an association.
Yeah.
Even beyond that, think of the amount of romance that they're just going to have to throw out, written by, you know, popular romance writers. I mean, it's not like the same-sex romance doesn't already exist in a lot of mainstream romance. So, I mean, well, okay, maybe not mainstream, but it is there. It might be a little bit, well, at least it's there in urban fantasy. I suppose I'm getting urban fantasy and romance mixed up, because let's be honest, urban fantasy kind of tends to swing towards the romance side. And
it really does.
Yeah.
So I wonder if they're just going to throw all that crap out too, you know?
Well, I have to say, I don't actually read a lot of romance that's not specifically SFNL or fantasy-ish. But one of the things that I do notice... excuse me, hiccuping here.
It's okay.
One of the things that I do notice is the heterosexual romance is all over the place, and most of it is fairly terrible.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a lot of... male homosexual romance floating around on the edges. But when it comes to female homosexual romances, and I only restarted to be aware of this because one of my friends pointed it out to me, because she wants more romances about people like her. And then I started looking, and really, where is it? It's not there.
Right.
Or at least it's not where you can find it easily.
And the question is, I mean, is their action, I mean, is it even not necessary? I mean, obviously, if the publishing community, if the romance publishing community already has kind of decided to reject same-sex entries, this seems kind of like a strong sort of slap in the face to the LGBT community. Because not only are they getting rejected by the mainstream romance publishing community, but now they have people telling them straight out, yeah, we're not even going to read them in the first place.
Yeah. And they say there's a note in the post where we've taken this from that someone got a response that said that some members of this chapter felt uncomfortable with same-sex entries. I make the assumption that by uncomfortable it's because it's gay stuff, but
it's icky and gay.
But I want to know, like, the full context. Is they uncomfortable because, like, the only kind of stuff they're being given is more often than not maybe of the more erotic strain? Because, I mean, I could understand
all romance erotic.
No, but some of it. Yes. I mean, more like the explicitly erotic.
Right.
I don't know enough about the RWA to know whether or not that is a factor, but I could understand if they're getting lots and lots of erotic gay romance that they might have a problem, but at the same time, there's a lot of context that seems just missing here, but either way, it seems that, well, what if somebody writes a really great, amazing, just kick-ass romance that happens to have two dudes or two ladies or whatever or some other mixture? I mean, are they willing to just throw that out because of somebody's icky feelings?
Yes.
I think yes. And, I mean, they say they're uncomfortable with it. And, you know, kind of speaking personally here, I am just a little bit uncomfortable with discrimination myself. I mean, do we really... I mean, I'm sort of at the point here where do we really need to keep saying this? Damn it. Yes, we do.
Yeah. That's the ridiculous part, is that we do. We have to keep repeating over and over and over again. I'm sorry, you guys are being discriminatory asswads, douche nozzles. I mean, we love our words because that's exactly
how about how wankers?
Wankers!
There
love
we
it.
Go.
Exactly! Let's go with the Brit sort of
yeah.
One. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous that this has to be pointed out on a consistent basis. There was just a report about some school, I think it's in Pennsylvania, but I'm not sure. And it was like a video of kids being full-on completely racist. And every time that happens, they need to be called out on it. Bigotry of all sorts needs to be called out every single time it's seen. Because unless it is, if we're just kind of sitting there going, eh, no problem, who cares? If that one chapter is uncomfortable with it, that's their issue. Then yeah. It never gets, I mean, it's obviously never going to be completely eradicated. We're probably always going to have problems with bigotry. But not on a sort of
institutional
level, exactly. And that's what these people are doing, is that they're creating, it's at an institutional level. Yeah, it's only one chapter, but
it's only one contest.
Exactly. But, yeah. If the RWA does not immediately come out and say this is unacceptable for a chapter under our umbrella, then it could continue and it could go through more chapters and more contests, which is completely unacceptable.
My only counterpoint to that would be this, that yes, I agree that we got to call it out, you know, call out BS when you see it. But my issue with that would be, well, that means that places that are that their membership, say a contest, like implicitly is against same-sex entries. Well, they know it's going to happen if they say that they're against those entries. So they just won't say that they won't ever let them win. They'll just like internally not allow it to happen. Now, I mean, imagine like you'll get cases where that you'll find out about that. There was a case with the Flash Fiction something, one of the Flash Fiction places, where it was found out that the editor was not okay with anything that gave a positive image of gay characters, and that stuff will get out. But I worry that, you know, yes, okay, ostracizing essentially bigotry, but then what happens to that bigotry if people are just hiding it? Does it become, like, institutionalized but unspoken?
Well, I think if you can force it far enough underground, personally, where it comes to the point where, I mean, you can call that bigotry to a certain extent, but there are times and places where it's not safe for an individual to call it out. So if you can force it on a general level far enough underground that it's mostly safe most of the time to call it out, then that's a massive step, just that.
Yeah.
I agree.
I mean, I have to look at places like where I live. I'm in California, USA. And racism in a lot of communities is not spoken about. I mean, you go to like the South or the Midwest in the United States, and at least they're kind of open and honest about their racism. Both sides are sort of duking it out, and it's out there and it's obvious. And out here, because it's quiet, it kind of becomes, to an extent, a little bit more systemic, which is why the conversation has to continue. I mean, yeah, you need to call it out when it's there, when you see it. But even if you're not seeing it, you still need to be talking about it, because I think that's when you win. If you can continue the conversation about a subject that is very difficult for a lot of people to deal with,
to face
in themselves.
It brings us to that issue of, you know, colorblindness, and you know,
right.
The people will say, like, I mean, we're talking U.S. politics, so I'm sorry, Liz, but
leave me out completely.
You know, I mean, because we don't know too much about the politics and the race or politics where you're from, but
In Ireland, it's only recently becoming, I suppose, racialized politics. There's a very, very strong anti-immigrant sentiment, I suppose, to a point where a lot of politicians aren't comfortable saying positive things about immigrants in public.
Mm-hmm. That sounds very familiar.
They will actually admit that in a private survey, but they won't say it out loud. But also our historical quote-unquote racism, I suppose, has been sectarianism.
Right.
And in Europe, I suppose a lot of racism is and isn't color-based. But you guys are talking mostly to a U.S. listenership, I suppose, so...
Well, I hope the people in the U.K. listen to this show. We're awesome. Well, I was saying, sort of, I mean, from a U.S. perspective, you know, we just elected Barack Obama. Well, not just. Several years ago, we elected Barack Obama. The first president with an African heritage, and yet now this has become the excuse. You know, we live in a post-racial society now, so like racism's gone because we got a black president. That's it, and that I think is what Jen, you're talking about. You know,
right?
We have all these quote unquote successes, and then suddenly we can just say, well, it's gone. Like, all, you know, Morgan Freeman is right. You know, you just stop talking about racism because it doesn't exist anymore. You know, and that's with any ism. You know, we make successes, you know, and some people want to say, like, you know, the feminists, like, they got what they wanted, and now let's just quit and be, you know, stop bitching about women's rights. You know, you got what you wanted.
Well, and let's bring it back
actually,
to the
actually, not yet.
Well, I know, I agree. But the argument is, like, you know, you quote-unquote got what you wanted, even though, like, when you look at all the statistical information, no. Like, you got, like, one-tenth of what you wanted.
Well, and let's look at the SpecFic community. Until there is an actual equal representation between, you know, both racial divides, gender divides, sexual divides, until you see it there, you probably can go, see, look, it's not even in the SpecFic community. So can we really say that we're, you know, actually doing well in the broader community? And I don't think so.
And there are a lot of underlying reasons for why there is not very equal representation. I mean, we could talk for hours and hours about that. I mean, who goes into, you know, the fact that a lot of people write science fiction happen to have science degrees, you know, and who goes into science? Well, it's predominantly white men. And that's a problem that has to be. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, we could attack one aspect, just the science fiction community, and say, let's make this better. But it's like, no, this is the broad culture as a whole that has to be changed. And unless that culture changes, everything that's attached to it won't change.
Right, exactly.
I don't know if Jen agrees with me, but maybe Liz doesn't.
How could I disagree? I mean,
I don't know.
You push things. I mean, I suppose you can push for change, and it's like you take 2 steps forward and then 1 3/4 steps back.
Oh, speaking of which, I had to bring up the fact that it wasn't, sadly for America, our presidential candidates agree with douche nozzle about women.
Yeah, the women can't.
Military.
Because Santorum, and I'm just going to say that word so you can look it up on your own time.
Exactly. I'm pretty sure that was actually, he is a representation of 2.5 steps to 3 steps back.
Yeah.
Can I just say that your American Republican candidates in the news look kind of insane from over here.
They look insane to us, too. And I would say, to a very general, the majority of Americans, the candidates that are on that side are looking really, really, really crazy and particularly radical. I would think the majority of Americans would agree that the quality, and I use that word very loosely, of candidates is disturbing.
One in five Republicans is planning on voting for Obama.
Yeah.
that's how bad the Republican field is these days.
Well,
sorry, nothing against Obama, but
you're President Obama at the moment. I mean, he's a pretty good president for a central right moderate.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, the irony, I think, and I don't want to go too political, but I think the irony is that our Republican nominations, like right now, if Republicans and, you know, there's the general populace, like, sat down and really thought about who President Barack Obama is, like, they wouldn't hate him so much. Like, he's done so many things that the right wants to do.
But he doesn't look like them.
I know, but that's because he's black.
Exactly.
And they don't like black people.
They're
supposed
exactly.
to, you know, he's not supposed to use the same water fountain. You know, there's a special, like, bathroom in the basement for him.
Yeah.
Sorry. Maybe
the black president's Oval Office. If Republicans had their way, that's probably how it would happen. So,
and just to be clear, we're talking about Republicans, not conservatives. I think those are two very different things.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, you know, think how many million times worse it would be if there was a black gay female president.
Oh my God!
And a civilization. Iran would have 10,000 nukes, and they would have nuked us into a crater.
Oh my God.
And then the caliphate would take over Europe. Yeah.
I mean, that's obviously what the Mayans were foretelling, I think.
Are you saying that we're going to have an independent come up who's a black gay female president and is going to win?
Presidential nominee. Yes, that's what's.
Well, and we're talking SF, no possibilities.
Exactly.
That would be hilarious. Okay, so why don't we, before we get, if we keep wandering down the political route, why don't we switch gears to the FlavorWire's 10 Great Science Fiction Books for Girls. I'm told, Liz, that you have issues with this particular thing.
I have a whole list of issues. Why don't you kick off, Sean, and I will root out my list from the papers on my desk.
Okay. Well, I think my central problem with this is really that it says for girls at the end, because I don't know what that means. What is it that defines, like, science fiction for girls? Because when you look at the list and you go, well, like, anybody could read these and would,
yeah.
I would imagine.
I have
like
no
them.
Idea what differentiates these books.
Okay.
From boys,
between
boy
adult
books.
And young adult. I have no clue, except maybe that it starts off with Madeline L'Engle, A Wrinkle in Time.
Yeah.
That's only one that I can tell that I was like, oh, yeah, that's totally for girls, whatever age category that might be. Even.
And I disagree with that, because I think I don't think that A Wrinkle in Time is a book specific for a gender. Anybody can read that.
No, it's not.
I have 3 questions just to start with. It's like, what do they mean by girls? Because do they mean teenagers, young women, or are they using girls in the sense of all of womanhood, which is kind of infantilizing, really?
Mm-hmm.
And the second question is, are these books that girls would enjoy? And the third question is, if they're books that girls would enjoy, how come less than half of them have a female protagonist? And I think two of them maybe have a female protagonist that doesn't suffer sexual violence. Correct me if I'm wrong here.
Yeah. The only one that I can figure out that I would actually hand to my kids is Nausicaa. Because yeah. I have two daughters, 9 and 11. So when I first read the title, I was like, well, presumably this is going to be a list for them. And I got all excited because I'm like, oh, yay, it's going to give me some great suggestions about what science fiction I should hand my children. And then I actually looked at the list and I was like, nope, not doing that one. Not doing that one. I think there were maybe two books in here.
Yeah.
I would give my kids. I
certainly wouldn't. I mean, The Wind Up Girl, I haven't managed to read more than a few pages into it. It's on my very, very long list. But from all the blurbs and all the talking about it, the main character is like literally a sex object.
Yes.
Who spends the book trying to become a real girl.
Yes.
Complete with graphic rape, apparently.
Yes.
Not
ever. I mean, I'll give that to my daughters when they're maybe in their 20s, maybe 30s, then I'll be comfortable with doing it, you know?
This is not a discussion you really want to have with a 12-year-old, is
it? It's not.
Really?
Maybe 16. I'll give 16. But at 11, it begs the question, when do we draw that line between girls and what we call anybody over whatever? What is the age range for girls?
I mean,
and to me, I think of my girls as girls at this point. But they're also 9 and 11. And if that's the case, if it's like, you know, let's go with under 12. Once they hit the teen years, not girls anymore. in my mind as a mother of two daughters, that's kind of where I'm going.
Yeah. I mean,
I cannot with good conscience give The Wind Up Girl to my kids.
Hell, The Wind Up Girl, can you give Stranger in a Strange Land?
No,
I can't. I like I said, the only one that I could give my kids is Nausicaa. And only because they've seen the movie.
Wrinkle in Time,
maybe Dune.
And Wrinkle in Time.
I read Dune when I was 12 and I don't think it warped me too much. But...
Well, yeah, exactly. There's the question. Did it warp you, or...?
I might have been already warped at that point.
Right.
The first science fiction fantasy book I remember reading was actually by Fred Saberhagen, however you pronounce his surname. The third book of Swords, and I was 8. So, yeah.
Right, and I read The Deed of Paxinarian, which has a reasonably... not as graphic as The Wind Up Girl, but still, it has a rape scene. And I read that when I was maybe 10 years old. But, you know, as a mom, I'm still kind of in that, like, oh my God, I can't expose my children to this. Because, you know, that's what we do. We panic over things like that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if my kids picked it up, I would not object to them reading it. There are certain things that I'm just like, it's a little too much for me.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's a tough call. But that's just like, that's the icing. I mean, that's like just the very barest edge of what's wrong with this list.
I mean, I sort of think a better thing to do with our time, rather than pick what's wrong with the list apart, is what would a right list look like for young adults or women who are just starting to get into skiffy and fantasy?
Yeah, and that's... Sean and I talk about this a lot, because... I mean, obviously, I'm still searching for those books that, you know, are perfect introductions to science fiction, at least. Fantasy is a little bit easier because it kind of is flooding the field of young adult books.
Yeah.
Science fiction is a lot more difficult, only because there isn't a lot of good examples of heroines in science fiction. that are also age appropriate.
Yeah.
I'd love to give my daughters Octavia Butler, but I think she might be a little bit beyond them still, maybe.
Shameful confession, I have never actually read anything by Octavia Butler.
I've only read a little bit, but what I did read, I was absolutely blown away by. But again, her books are not, they're not easy by any stretch, and probably not what I would hand my daughters at their age.
Yeah, I mean, I read recently, because I went out and looked for it, I read recently sort of, it's basically a young adult romance set in a space opera universe, Academy 7, something like that. And it was just like, I went out looking for science fiction for young readers, young adults, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And that was the first one I found. I've heard of a couple of others, I can't remember their names, which are like Generation Ship in Space and stuff like that. But Academy 7 was basically, you could see the cardboard in the background of the setting, basically. You could see the stage setting and all the great gaping holes where it didn't really work. But I still really enjoyed it.
Right.
It had spaceships and things blowing up.
And now you have, like, The Hunger Games at least has a strong female character, mm-hmm. which is nice. And that's actually the next book that I'm planning on getting my kids, because it's one of the few that I've really heard about and know that has a strong female character. Mm-hmm. So what else? I loved Anne McCaffrey. Anne McCaffrey was probably my first introduction to science fiction for women.
The funny thing, going back and reading that again, I went back and read again the first three books when I heard she died, mm-hmm. is that all the stuff I didn't notice when I was 12, is there's some really skeevy stuff in there. Lesser falls in love with Flar after... He's basically admitted in his own point of view that what he does... their sexual relationship is like rape. It's literally point blank. He comes out and says that while he's thinking in his point of view. It's like, wait, you missed this at 13.
Which book is this?
The first book.
Of
McCaffrey's Dragon Riders.
Oh, see, and that's, I never read the whole series of Dragon Riders, so it's part of my problem, and probably one of the benefits, maybe. I only did
the Dragon Harper of Pern ones?
Yes, Harper something. And that's, I actually just recently purchased those for my kids. I was like, here, take these.
They're nice.
Right, they're nice, they're easy, exactly. They're very soft.
30 years on, I would love to see more young adult science fiction, or at least young adult fantasy sci-fi world that doesn't involve fighting the patriarchy, basically. Mm. Yeah, Menelaus is still the only girl in the Harper Hall.
Right. So, but at least it's something. And that's like, that's what I'm forced to resort to. At least it's something.
Well, I would add to the list, although it's not in a science fiction adventure, Susan Beth Pfeffer.
Pfeffer.
Okay, mm-hmm. Pfeffer. She has a really great trilogy of books, and I forget the title that they're put under, but one of the books is The Dead and the Gone. Oh, gosh, I've forgotten. One is called This World We Live In, etc. The very first book, and I forget what the title of the first book is, the basic premise is that something hits the moon, a very large asteroid, strikes the moon and changes its orbit, and it's about a family trying to survive in the aftermath of what the environmental impact of that is, and it's told in epistolary form through the letters, the diary entries of the main, the protagonist, who's a young girl who's right at that age of becoming, I guess, a quote-unquote woman. I don't know when you would... She's essentially, you know, that early teenage years. And I think those are really would be great for kids, because they talk about, you know, all of the kinds of thing for young adults that you would normally expect to talk about for young adults. They talk about family, and it's just really, I think they're really great books. And I'm surprised that they're not on this list, because those seem to me that whether for girls or for non-girls or whoever, those seem like great books.
Yeah. Excuse me. The other thing I was thinking about with the list is, even as an even not for young adults, as an introductory list of shit women would like, might like to read in terms of science fiction and fantasy, or just science fiction, it's really out of date, apart from The Wind-Up Girl and Nausicaa, and it's not really that great in terms of you know, having female protagonists.
Yeah, and that was one of my problems with it, too, is a number of the texts they picked, it seemed like they just picked them because they're feminist texts, which I'm not saying that them being feminist texts is wrong. My problem was that somehow this is associated, like, well, women will like him because they're feminist books.
Oh, yeah, well, I find The Handmaid's Tale impossible to read, and I am a self-described cranky, hairy-legged feminist, so...
I've not actually read
that. And I'm still only halfway through The Female Man, and I have been halfway through The Female Man for over a year.
But those are... And that sort of presents the problem, right? I mean, would somebody... who is a woman, a girl, well, I'm just going to say women because I think they were way off the mark with girls. But would women by default, like, automatically like The Female Man? And my thought is no.
Not unless you were really into postmodernist narrative gameplay, yeah.
Right, I mean...
Which is an extremely small subset of any reader.
Yeah, it seems like what they really need to think about was, who is the average... female reader, like what is it that they read on average, the kind of stuff that they're reading, and then take that as like a template for, okay, well, what kind of science fiction books have those qualities that female readers tend to like?
You know, I mean, what kind of books what are good science fiction books that have women in them, even, which is not necessarily as large as could be hoped? I mean, you've got Sandra MacDonald with her Outback Stars, and you've got Elizabeth Baer's Dust Chill Grail, and some of her other books. I mean, as a science fiction book for women, I would completely recommend Baer's Carnival, because it's about two gay spies visiting a planet ruled basically by women, which is an interesting... which is a really interesting sort of reversal of what normally happens in science fiction. But, I mean, I can think of a very long list of books that I would recommend to women of my acquaintance who are looking to get into science fiction before any one of these books.
Yeah.
And it's like, I mean, okay, if you like reading romance, there's Sandra MacDonald and Linnea Sinclair and a couple of other people who are writing science fiction with romancy bits in, and then you've got sort of science fiction with caper plots in that have women, or hell, Baer's Dust trilogy is kind of epic for space generation stuff with the whole cool shit trademark type stuff. But and then there's Charles Stross. His near future SF stuff, it's kind of head explodingly new concept, but some of his the two books that he wrote that was space opera, and Glasshouse as well. Okay. I'd totally recommend them before Ender's Game or Stranger in a Strange Land. I'm not sure I'd recommend Stranger in a Strange Land to anyone who wasn't into cultish poly, not that poly is cultish, but cultish stuff and or poly stuff. That's kind of, he's kind of a skeevy messiah.
Well, and this really, I mean, this goes right back to your original point that this list is so crazy out of date. I mean, the earliest text in here is is Frankenstein, which is what, 1850,
50s,
somewhere around there. Right.
Yeah.
And then there's, of course, you know, there's Dune, which is, you know, like tail end of Golden Age era. I mean,
it still holds up pretty well in terms of cool shit. But
yeah, I love Dune. I mean, it's one of my favorite. I've read the whole series, sadly.
Yeah. But this is the...
I should be proud of that.
It's sad that Paul's an asshole.
Sorry. Oh, I'm sorry, wait, what?
It's kind of sad that Paul's an asshole, but, you know. But it doesn't change the fact that it's still a pretty good book.
I mean, my thing is that, like, and I'm guilty of this. I do not read enough science fiction by women. The question is why I don't read enough science fiction by women.
Well, part of it is because we're not getting a lot of women science fiction authors who want to be on this show. Hint, hint, well, wink, wink.
We need more of them. No, I'm talking about over the span of my life. I have not read a lot of science fiction, female science fiction authors. I have not read Elizabeth Baer. I have not read Sandra MacDonald or any. I have not read. Only recently did I read Octavia Butler, and that was only because everybody was like, Genesis, it's awesome, it's amazing, you must read it. And I read some other vampire book that she wrote. But part of that is that when I walk into a bookstore and I'm looking for science fiction books, I still tend to stick with what I know or what my father has read. And my father, let's be honest, he doesn't read a lot of female science fiction authors either. But they're also not marketed very well, I think, at least in terms of if you're going into a big box store particularly, they don't hold the prevalent positions that the male authors do. The fantasy is much easier to find. And go ahead.
Keep going. Well, I was just thinking that people like Justina Robson, and who's not really writing science fiction anymore. I think her latest series I read the first two books of it. It's this crossover between science fiction and fantasy, which is called Quantum Gravity series. But her earlier science fiction, I can't see it in the bookshops anymore. And people like Tricia Sullivan, I've been trying to track down some of her books for a while, and they're not quite easy to find in an actual bookshop. I mean, you can get them online, but I'm trying not to buy too many books online. They're just too tempting.
I need to reread Justina Robson, because I remember I read the God Flower... God. Crazy title, and I've forgotten the name of the
Falling in Love, something like The God of Love Next Door or something.
Yeah, I read that, and I remember I hated it, but I was also really dumb when I read that, so I think I should go back and reread it.
I read it too, and bits of it were interesting, and bits of it were compelling, and if I was like 100% smarter, I feel like I would have got it.
I think that was part of my problem too, is I think I was fairly early in my college career, and I don't think I was a very sophisticated reader at the time. And I think if I went back now, I probably would have a very different appreciation for it.
Yeah. Do you know who else is writing science fiction? Cameron Hurley, God's War, and which was kind of, it was like this mad bug technology Islamic quasi-permanent war future planet. Which was really weird and really interesting and had the most unpleasant, compelling female protagonist as its point of view character, really, that I have ever read.
Okay.
She was so unpleasantly compelling. It was like you just wanted to kick her and say, stop being nasty to people. Oh, wait, the world you live in kind of compels you to be nasty to people. All right, go ahead. Kill lots of people. Do horrible things to yourself.
So that's another one we got to put on our list. And Jen, definitely you need to read some of this.
I know. There's a lot I need to read.
Yeah.
Quit reminding me of that fact.
If you would just do it.
Yeah, I mean, just go for Carnival. Or, I mean, even her first trilogy is sort of near future.
Yeah.
And the wonderful thing is that there are women and gay people and black people and people of multicolors everywhere.
Really?
Yes. in her stuff. I mean, the whole Dust trilogy, some of the people were blue.
And there's also, she plays with sexuality. In Dust in particular, she plays with sexuality. There are characters who, I'm not going to say anything. I know, because I don't want to ruin the book, because it's good. Carnival, I agree. Carnival is particularly a fantastic book. And Jen, you would quite enjoy that one, I think.
Okay. Yeah. I will go buy it as soon as I have a dollar.
Yeah. You will. Okay, so I think we kind of mind this particular one, and we agree the list essentially sucks. It's old-fashioned and before
terrible.
Yeah, generally terrible. Yeah, and before anybody writes a response list of 10 great science fiction books for girls, maybe they need to sit down and define what the hell they mean by girls and what they mean by the four.
Yeah.
Because you can't
define your terms, people. Define your terms.
Right. Because the closest this thing came to is there's one line that says lots of girls and women love science fiction. So that means that there's a difference between women and girls, but girls is not defined, and neither is women. What do they mean by women? When are they defining womanhood?
When does girl become woman? Or yeah. Okay. I don't even want to think about the thought process that goes into that there, really.
Probably just a fairly simple, you know, like, I don't know. But, I mean, it's written by, we can assume, Emily Temples, who wrote this post. So I will assume that Emily Temple is actually a woman and not somebody pretending to be a woman. Which has happened, oddly enough. So anyways, sorry. So why don't we, to our last little bit, which is from the World SF blog, which is the Global Women in Science Fiction Roundtable, featuring Aliette de Baudard, Joyce Ching, is there a letter missing there? I don't know. Scylla Kleinheinz, Kate, I'm sorry, I'm butchering names and I apologize. Kate Elliott, Karen Lord, and Ekaterina Sadia. Who've come from various parts of the world. Kate Elliott is the only local for us.
Technically, Ekaterina Sadia lives in the United States and has for a very long time, but
okay,
she's originally Russian.
Yes. That works. So, I guess, Liz, what do you think are some of the major points that we should be sort of interrogating? Because there's so much going on in this roundtable.
There's an incredible lot, and let's not forget, it was last summer, and I only came across it recently. So there's an entire conversation out there around what the world science fiction and women in world science fiction as well that I'm only just coming to. But one of the things it really resonated with me because I'm based in Ireland, and a lot of the I suppose US centric assumptions of science fiction, sometimes they're UK centric assumptions too. I'm not just holding up a great big pointing finger and pointing it at United States of America and saying stop focusing on your own navels. It's pretty much UK centric stuff it happens as well. But I think the thing is the thing that I hadn't even realized is there's a whole world of people outside the US, the UK, even people writing in English outside of them that I didn't really know about before. And I think one of the interesting things for me when I come to read science fiction and fantasy written by people based in the States, Carrie Sparing had a blog post on this in the summer as well, that when people in the US and sometimes in the UK play with other people's cultures or say, Carrie Sparing's post way back in the summer was about Connie Willis's remarks on the Blitz, is that you're playing with other people's cultural assumptions, and I think you're assuming that then, I'm not saying you, it's like a general you. One is assuming that there aren't people out there already having that conversation in a sort of science fiction fantasy, in the fantasy genre. You just might not have read it before because it's not been published in English or whatnot.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I think was really important that, I think by now people understand there is a thing called World SF, which is a problematic term on its own, but that so much of the stuff that is not written in English, we will probably never see because there just isn't a culture of translation in the US. I mean, there is, but it's very small because translation is so expensive. And the way publishing works now, it's, how do you market, here's a random, author from Bulgaria that nobody's ever heard of, and let's put it in English and sell it to English readers. How do you sell it? Well, I don't know. I'm not a marketing expert, but that, they, we don't have enough of this stuff being circulated in our circles, and so to some extent our conversations about genre fiction, and as a number of them had pointed out in this roundtable, become so centered. Whenever there's a problem, it's always centered on U.S. interest or U.K. interest as it's relevant. Like, for example, Race Fail gets brought up a number of times, and one of the people mentioned that, yeah, I see a lot of discussion about racism, and that's really great, but it's always within the U.S. perspective, and that if there's any discussion of race as it relates to other cultural paradigms, that it's always on the margins, and not as though it's not a part of the underlying problems of genre fiction as a community.
Yeah, one of the other problems, I suppose, speaking as a European and an outsider, I mean, even to the UK sort of set of cultural assumptions, is that the stuff that gets translated into other languages means that people who's that stuff from America and the UK gets translated into other languages a lot more than the reverse. Mm-hmm. So the people from those other language groups, and even some of us from the Anglosphere who don't have a large native SF or science fictional or whatever literary or visual media culture, get used to, I suppose, viewing the world or parsing the world through those sort of US or UK centric goggles, which brings with it its own set of problems and a sort of.
I loved Karen's point right at the end that, you know, her books aren't even considered fantasy at home because the supernatural is so, it's such a long tradition of including the supernatural in their stories that, and because of the U.S., you know, the continual translation of U.K. and U.S.-centric works, that the only things that are considered fantasy really are the elves and the orcs, the kind of main tropes of Western fantasy. And meanwhile, the things that might very well be tropes in other cultures, we just don't see them. And how interesting would it be to have them as one of our tropes?
Yeah.
Can I just say about elves how sick I am of pan-Celtic Irish elves?
I know, they're all Irish, aren't they?
And they're not even, you know, recognizably Irish elves. They're like this kind of
Have you seen Saint Patrick's Day
elf.
Sci-fi's Lost Girl, by any chance whatsoever?
I have. I really enjoy it. But can they stop with the Irish, not even quasi-Irish, sort of semi-Irish, slightly Irish accents?
Well, it's not, I mean, even beyond that. One, okay, it's like, why bother with accents? Two, seriously, these are supposed to be people who have a long Irish tradition, and yet none of them look like they have any Irish ancestry whatsoever? It's kind of, it's a very bizarre...
To be fair, they are magic beings, but...
Magic, yes. Obviously, that explains everything. It explains the black dude with the New York accent who is randomly follows all the Irish cultural sort of norms, if they're even norms,
they're not. I mean, it's like, it's basically whenever I see, you know, Celtic... And I am saying this in quotation marks. I'm trying to say it in quotation marks. Sort of Celtic mythology done from an American point of view. It's like I'm sort of holding myself tightly, hugging myself, saying, "How bad is it going to be?"
Never ever go to an SCA tournament. That's all I'm saying.
It's because. The other thing, I mean, I actually read some, I like urban fantasy. Right. I even like urban fantasy with elves, but, and sort of Irish deities. I have quite a soft spot in my head, in my heart, even, not, well, maybe a soft spot in my head as well, for Kevin Hearn's Hounded.
Oh, yeah.
But, oh my sweet godless heavens, that boy is a surfer dude.
yeah, a little bit, yeah, I agree. I really like the book, though.
They're fun books.
The whole world perspective thing brings me back to the conversation we had with Nick Mamatas, which, in light of the discussion we just had about, you know, women in science fiction and everything, we asked, you know, I was like, oh, okay, so are there any books with strong female? He's like, oh, actually, that's really common in Japan. And I'm going, really? Why don't they give us more of those? That would be really nice, because we're kind of lacking it in the U.S. To an extent. And yeah. Especially for young adults. And he was like, oh, yeah, it's really common. There's strong female characters in half the books. And I was like, are you freaking kidding me? Why? But you don't hear about these things unless, you know, you go through things like the World SF Book. Because it's not enough a part of our marketing, at least, of our publishing industry.
Yeah.
We like to, you know, colonize the world with our books, but we don't allow any reverse.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Just a little bit. I say this as someone who is intensely, immensely fond of an awful lot of Americans and an awful lot of American and British science fiction and fantasy. But yeah, just a little bit. And the really funny thing is when I sort of read, this is complete tangent, I suppose, when I read a fantasy book that's sort of urban fantasy or sort of so-called Northern European fantasy, and all the local mythologies got like poured into a cauldron and blended. So that sort of stuff that's intensely local or could be intensely local, like the North, the Yorkshire and then the Borderlands ballad tradition, is right there alongside Morrigan and Cú Chulainn and the Dagda and, you know, Cernunnos, who I think is from Bretagne in France. It weirds me out a bit.
Yeah. Well, we like to put all of our myths, 2,000 at least years of them, into a blender and then just let it mix for a while. And then we dump it on our books and call it good.
And then we say it's original.
Okay. Original, right.
So it's basically the mixing up of ketchup and barbecue sauce and mayo. And
That sounds revolting.
Yeah.
That is a bad metaphor, but
but it gets the revulsion, I guess, you're looking for.
I don't mind it so much with mythology, but then when you come to the whole fantasy books that never really seem to understand how medieval lordship or medieval transport or sort of medieval travel works, it's don't understand how medieval laundry works either.
And are you a medievalist?
No, I'm a classicist.
Ah, okay. So you would be the person to go when I want to write my 25-book fantasy epic that is ostensibly an allegory of a major period of medieval history.
I would recommend you not go to medievalist with that. Yeah.
Well, because then people will get really confused when it's accurate.
Yeah, because that's one of the issues I have, you know, speaking of writing about essentially other cultures, because a medieval or classical culture to Americans is completely divorced from our history, because we don't have that. We have no medieval culture. It's gone.
Your ancestors just did some sort of weird genocide thing for a lot of
right.
it.
Right. The Americas had a medieval culture, at least around at the same time as the, you know, so-called British medieval culture. We don't have any relation to that. Those are, you know, those other people. They're not like us.
And that's what Liz just said. I mean, we essentially exterminated that culture so that what little we know, I mean, there are entire tribes that we will never know anything about except what we can dig up. Because we destroyed them. and they're gone.
That's also true in some parts of Europe as well, places that didn't have a strong written culture. It's very, very hard to reconstruct.
It's really depressing. That's why I hope we invent a time machine so we can go back and learn this stuff. But then I realize that makes me kind of a little... like it's
you
a
want
little...
to go colonize the past, too!
Yeah, see, that's the problem. But for me, it's sort of like one of the things I get so angry about, like as a post-colonial scholar, is, you know, reading about cultures that we know snippets, but we only know snippets because of colonizers and because of what they wrote down, which is always within a colonial gaze, and so they blah blah blah. But that there are entire cultures that we will never know anything about because a bunch of douchebag white people showed up and said they're not Christians, let's subjugate them and destroy their culture. And that drives me up the wall.
Quite an awful lot. I'm not to get all sort of North European exceptionalist on you here, but dominant nations didn't just do that to brown people, I have to say.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
There's the whole Albigensian heresy, where the Pope and some French guys went down to sort of the south of France and basically exterminated all the heretics.
The heretics in quote marks?
Well, they were heretical from the Catholic point of view.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
They were sort of nice, fluffy heretics that were all about love and not hurting other people. Or at least that's how their propaganda, after centuries, the rediscovery of the sort of Albigensians. But, you know, heretics. Gotta kill them.
And that's fair. You know, I mean, Europe, as it were, I mean, essentially did similar things, that, you know, in destroying its own cultures. I mean, you think about, and you know more about this than I do, so I'm going to say something that is completely devoid of full context, but, you know, what Rome did to the cultures of England.
I actually once had an exam question on Roman Britain that compared the Romans to the Borg. I just have to say that. You will be assimilated.
That's
resistance
awesome.
Is futile. Does this apply? It's not, when we're talking about the Romans, it's not that simple because they didn't have this idea of, oh, we have to make other cultures just like us. It was, if you wanted to get ahead in Rome, sure, you needed to speak Latin and whatever, but you're far enough from the center in Roman Britain and the provinces that a lot of what goes along is less assimilation than accommodation and a multiplicity. Yeah, can never say that word properly. A multiplicity of identities so that, you know, when you're interacting with the legionaries, you speak Latin and you're a toga wearing, not unless you're a citizen, but most people within the Roman Empire were citizens after Caracalla extended citizenship to everybody. I think it was Caracalla. I always get confused with all the emperors called with their, whose names begin with C. There's too many of them.
Well, to be fair, Jen and I don't know any better.
We don't know any of them. So
you could just say, you know, like, Cthulhu did this. And you'd be like, yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
But wasn't there more assimilation in terms of what the Vikings did when they came to Britain than even what the Romans did?
I'm not really a Britonist or even a Romanist. My area of quasi hopeful eventual expertise is sort of the Greek Hellenistic and Roman period.
Gotcha.
But my understanding is there was less Viking and Saxon. There were like multiple waves of invasion into Britain and the Isles. And how it all boils down into you get this sort of, well, Saxon, you get Saxon kingdoms and you get sort of North Viking kingdoms, and then in Wales you have Welsh kingdoms, and then you've got Manx and the islands and Cornwall, and sometimes they do their own thing and sometimes they don't. Manx actually maintained its own language group. The Isle of Man its own language group up until the 1950s, when the last native speaker of Manx died. And Cornwall had its own language group as well.
The Manx have the incredibly difficult language, don't they?
Well,
exceedingly.
It's a variation of Celtic. It's a P-Celtic rather than a Q-Celtic language. I mean, Scots Gaelic and Irish are Q-Celtic languages, and Welsh and Manx and the language spoken in the Breton area of France are P-Celtic languages.
I'm gonna ask a dumb question. What is Q-Celtic and P-Celtic? What does that mean?
The Q-Celtic languages have the hard C sounds, hard C-K sounds.
Okay.
And the P-Celtic languages have a preponderance of P and B sounds, more so than the aspirated. This is me remembering stuff I learnt in Irish class in school about 7-8 years ago now. I could still speak a little bit of Irish.
We didn't have the benefit of going through Irish school, so we have to ask Irish people these questions. It kind of goes to my point, though, is that
Wikipedia knows. Ask Wikipedia about P and Q Celtic languages.
The fact that there were so many waves in terms of the, you know, conquer of Britain over and over and over again, and yet most of our sort of fantasy take place in this world that's got every wave combined into one.
You do have the sort of final Norman invasion of England in the 12th century, but 10th, 11th, 11th. It's the 11th century.
Yeah.
I mean, even that Norman, I mean, you've got several different languages still being spoken.
Hmm.
The language of the upper class, of the conquering classes, the French, which was French for like 2 or 3 centuries, and then you've got Latin, and then you've got English, the sort of still the English, not still the English of Beowulf, gradually becoming the English of Chaucer and Shakespeare and whatnot.
And that eventually becomes English as we know it.
English as she are spoke. Yeah.
And I should just note that I hate the Norman invasion of 1066 because it ousted my ancestors from rule, and I disapprove greatly.
It ousted your ancestors from rule?
Yeah.
What do you think happened when the Normans invaded Ireland? They were invited in. My ancestors, well, on one side anyway, some of my ancestors were idiots, and some of my other ancestors were the people who invaded. I have a Norman surname.
Yeah. I just find it amusing. My mom has done the genealogical sort of tracing back, and our family on her family's side is one of the few that you can trace it back far enough to pre the invasions. And so it's really fascinating to find out, you know, that, well, my family used to own parts of Yorkshire, and I'm like, that's awesome. What happened? And then, you know, then you find out that, well, fell out of favor with the royalty, and then eventually they kind of went to America because, yeah, it's depressing.
Please tell me it's only white Americans that are this obsessed with their ancestry. I'm really hoping.
I'm pretty sure it's mostly Americans who are that obsessed with genealogy. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, I feel much better now.
Well, my mom did it because she wanted to. She did it initially because she wanted to know, because she's adopted. So her blood relatives, she wanted to know initially were there any heart disease, those kinds of things, because those are health questions. And, well, if you've got a history of heart disease, you've got to deal with it early.
So she went back 10 centuries.
Well, she started. She started, and then she just couldn't stop because my mom's obsessive compulsive.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't make fun of your mom.
It's okay. Genealogy is like, it's our own individual attempts to recreate the mythology of our families.
Yeah. Fantasy. In a sense, genealogy is a kind of fantasy.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of, I mean, I only know it from my own perspective, but one of the things in fantasy that's never really acknowledged is how
none of Europe is really, I will probably piss off an awful lot of people who have illusions about this, but none of Europe is really culturally pure. You've always got these incoming waves of elites or economic migration or what have you. So if you, I mean, you go back far enough in my family in Ireland, the bits of it that didn't come in 100 years ago from Yorkshire and Scotland, they were late immigrants. But you go back far enough and you have conquerors on one side and conquerees, the conquered on the other. And you've got people making accommodations in their families and people who don't. It's never cut and dried. It's never simple. There are never really. The whole Irish struggle for home rule, for independence, it's less a war of independence than it was a very long, very drawn out civil war with outbreaks of terroristical violence that were more to do, as much to do really, with the relationship between landlord and tenant as between state and mob. But you don't get that. You don't get a lot of that in fantasy. A lot of the stuff that's sort of lionized and mythologized in Irish history as part of the great revolutionary struggle really had a lot more to do with the local power elite struggles. I mean, the king that was crowned in Ireland in the, I think it was the 15th century, the one that Henry had as his potboy. That was a lot more about local elite power struggles than it was about any idea of independence. And one of the things that comes up sometimes in fantasy is that either it's all completely grim and dark and everybody gets maimed and mutilated and hurt horribly and there's no good guys and there's no bad guys because the good guys are the bad guys and no one has any sort of moment of hope or joy or accommodation. You've got that, and then on the other hand, you've got these wonderful black, white, and I'm sometimes actually literally quite specifically, see Tolkien, oppositions right. between the good and the pure revolutionaries who really only want to put the lost heir on the throne, and the bad guys who kick puppies and rape little children.
I like how that's your bad guys, is they kick puppies.
And
that's
they rape little children, criteria. Yes. And either you can have it all horrible or you can have it all sort of this really clear division, and there's no such sort of historical division between, okay, everything was horrible and there was no glimmer of light for anybody and they all died horrible deaths except for the ones who clawed their way to the top and stayed there.
Well, that's, I hate to break it to you, but that's the, you know, American dream right there. So hence why so much of our literature probably ends up dealing with people clawing their way to the tops.
Yeah, a lot of people historically were perfectly happy to claw their way to the middle.
The middle, right. Yeah, the middle!
I'd happily claw my way to the middle.
The top of the bottom, you know, that's yeah. something at least.
But one of the things that historically people did was that they pulled people up with them. Mm-hmm. If somebody made it good, they'd have made good based not just on themselves but on other people's efforts. There was an expectation of patronage and mm-hmm. of sort of distributing largesse, I suppose.
Yeah.
If only we could convince our 1% of that. And now that we have firmly gotten back in the realm
back to
of politics.
Well, we have kind of run a bit far afield, and I think we should probably wrap it up.
Well, we have gone over our hour.
Yeah, we did. Halfway. Yeah, yeah, we've been talking for a while.
Really?
Yeah, you We're must good. Love us, you know.
time goes fast when you're having fun.
Exactly.
So where can people find you if they want to, like, stalk you on the internet?
Oh, well, if they want to stalk me on the internet, I'd really prefer that they didn't. But most of my interesting posts either go up at Tor or occasionally I review for Strange Horizons or for Idiomancer.com. If you really, really want to stalk me, I'm not going to tell you where to find me, because that's what Google's for.
Cool, so they can find, but Tor.com, Strange Horizons, Idiomancer, those are all great places to find your reviews.
Those are great places to find what I'm talking about, yeah. If you you want to find me, I suppose you can.
Okay, we will facilitate stalking then. Well, if anybody wants to send us a message or leave a comment or whatever, you can do that in one of four ways. You can go to Twitter.
Twitter.com/Skiffy and Fanty.
Email.
Crap. You got me. Skiffyandfanty@gmail.com. I was thinking about it too hard.
Blog.
Skiffyandfanty.com.
Or Google, Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
Yep, and there's also Facebook, and you just look for Skiffy and Fanny Show. So, thank you so much, Liz, for being on the show and talking with us about really numerous, yeah, pretty much everything. It was great.
Thank you for having me.
Definitely.
Come back again someday.
Yeah, when you cause more trouble, we'll get you back on.
I'm Skippy.
I'm hoping that won't happen for a while, but it might, because I gave a truly truly picky review to a book that the review should be coming out in a month or so.
How exciting. Hopefully it's not someone we're interviewing, because that's just, you know,
awkward.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we did interview Michael Sullivan, by the way, so.
Well, I don't know, when a book is about female super soldiers who are between the ages of 16 or 18, the protagonist wants to make them into real girls with feelings, and oh, by the way, if they're not shot when they're 18, they start to rot within weeks. Yeah, you kind of have to be picky.
That sounds a bit like Model Land.
Oh, no, don't read it. No, that's it, guys.
So, we're done.
Take care. No.
Cool. We'll see everybody next week with Tobias Bekel.
Oh, yes. Have
yeah.
a good one.
Bye. Our new intro music is Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.